So, as I was saying, it's a subject that's old, but it had some kind of a rebirth in the mid-80s, and I'll tell you about that. And what's happened is there's a new wrinkle in the subject, but it's a new wrinkle on an old wrinkle, and I'll tell you all about that. And I'm going to give you the lecture the way I like to give lectures these days, I guess because I'm getting older. I like to give them in the form of a story. So you will hear a story with people, with places, and all kinds of local color added in, and there will be quite a bit of mathematics throughout the whole lecture, so we'll be going back and forth. And I think the thing to do is to touch on the people and the characters as they appear in this story, in the mathematics. So I won't try to give you a really coherent story right from the beginning, but let me say that this rebirth, can you hear me back there? Well, I have this thing on. Okay. Am I deafening you up here? No. Okay. This rebirth, interestingly enough, began in, so 83, let's say probably May of 83. I'm not quite sure of what it was, May, or it must have been May or possibly April of 83. Right here in Toronto, not the Fields Institute, there was none at that time, but right here in Toronto, and the real hero of the whole beginning is someone named Terry Gardner. Many of you will know Terry, and but there'll be some younger people here who don't know him. And I'll tell you how he's the real hero of the beginning of this as the mathematics develops in this lecture. Okay, so let me begin. With some notation, so we're all on the same page here. A is a C-star algebra acting on a Hilbert space. U of A, cap script U of fractu A, determinant A, is the unitary group of A, and when it's clear which C-star algebra is involved, then it'll always be A, script A, so it will be clear. Then I might write just U, not U of A. A little parentheses to indicate a ball around the A with a sub 1 is the closed unit ball. The operators are norm less than or equal to 1 in A. If I put a little cap script, well, is it? Yeah, maybe. Oh, that's, yeah, that might be fine. Is that? Does that make it better for everybody back there? It is a little better, but I thought it was pretty readable as it was. Trouble is, with the lights off, I may fall asleep and fall off the platform here. So. You know the classic professor's nightmare? He dreams he's giving a lecture about something he knows nothing about, and he wakes up and he finds he is. I don't want to get myself into that. Okay. So the little O there is the open unit ball, operators less than 1, and that less than and less than equal to is going to play quite a role in this. It's something. The main point of the lecture is a sharp inequality of sorts. And the main point, by the way, is joint paper coming out with Uffe Hoogerup and Gerd Petersen. And it's dedicated to the memory of Gerd Petersen, and it will appear, it's about to appear in math scan. There are two issues of math, Mathematica Scandinavica. That's two issues that are about to appear, dedicated to Geir Pedersen. And this is an article that will be in the second issue. I think it's maybe the beginning article in that. That's the new wrinkle that we're talking about. Okay, so the less than and the less than or equal to are relevant, quite relevant in this lecture. Okay. A plus on top of that A1 means the set of positive elements in there, so the notation is all fairly standard. COU of A is the set of finite convex combinations of unitary operators in the C-star algebra, as indicated. Two bars up above is the norm closure. This is pretty sloppy. This is CO here. It's the norm closure of CO of U of A. And here's some notation that will come into serious play toward the end of the lecture. That's the set script P. Script P is sort of an indication. It was, I think, Uffe's choice of notation. Way back, you'll hear part of that story when it's relevant. Script P is the set of operators representable in the C-star algebra, representable as a unitary in the algebra times a positive element in the unit ball. In particular, any invertible element in the C-star algebra is in P, because its polar decomposition is in the C-star algebra in that case, and the isometry part of it is a unitary, and the other part is, okay. So any invertible operator in the unit ball, I should say, has its positive part in the unit ball. SP of T, usual sort of notation for all of us, it's the spectrum of the operator T. Set of complex numbers lambda, such that T minus lambda times the identity operator does not have a two-sided inverse in the C-star algebra, in any C-star algebra containing it, as a matter of fact. Okay. The first I know of operators being expressed as convex combinations of unitary operators is actually due to Murray and von Neumann. I wouldn't want to try to guess which one of the two, Murray or von Neumann. Could have been either one, but probably von Neumann knew this even before. It appears in the second of the papers in their great series, Rings of Operators papers. Rings of Operators 2, it's in the Transactions of the American Math Society, strangely enough. It's a couple of pages up from the beginning of the paper. They meet it. And they note that each self-adjoint operator in the unit ball, norm less than or equal to 1, is the mean of a unitary operator and its adjoint. And the proof is, just take the operator A. A squared is a positive operator less than or equal to the identity, because A is in the unit ball. It's positive square root times I plus A is a unitary operator with, it's an operator with adjoint A minus I times the square root of I minus A squared. And you just multiply the two together in any order. That square root is a unique positive square root of the operator. You multiply the two in any order and you get the identity, so it's a unitary. Of course, you add them together, and so on and so forth. This is a well-known fact. It follows that any T in P is also the average of two unitaries, but they are now not necessarily U plus the adjoint operator, U star. Reason, H, if T is in P, then it's a unitary times a positive operator in the unit ball, and the positive operator in the unit ball, as we just saw, is one half of U plus U star, and the U of the polar of the U of the representation of T and P multiplies the U star, and you get that operator in P represented as one half U times U times U naught plus U times U naught star. Okay. If T is in the unit ball and is invertible, then it's in P. I think I remarked that a moment ago. Okay. I move over to this slide over here. The next phase of this decomposition is the famous Russo-Dye theorem. Theorem that says each operator in the each operator in the unit ball of the C star algebra A is a norm limit of finite convex combinations of unitary operators in A. And that's for people who work a lot on the analytic side, the analysis side, the estimates of C star algebra theory. This is an absolutely key result. This was in 1966, the Duke Journal. Bernie Russo was Henry Dye's graduate student. The only thing I don't like about this result is that Henry, being as kind as he was, insisted that Bernie Russo put his name first. And I'm a stickler for alphabetic order. That's my only complaint about this result, the Russo-Dye theorem. Now, the point there, I think part of the motivation there was a theorem that was very important to us and to many people in functional analysis elsewhere, the Krein-Milman theorem, locally convex topological linear space, compact convex set, is the closed hull of its extreme points. Now, in an old paper in 1951 Annals, the extreme points are identified as those operators V, they have to be partial isometries, those operators V, such that V star V is a projection operator in the C star algebra E, the initial space of the partial isometry, and V V star must then be another projection, which will be the closed range, the projection on the closed range of the partial isometry V. So E and F are projections in A, as I say. And I minus E times A, so the crucial condition is hiding off in the shadow over there. There it is. I minus E times the algebra, I'm writing it schematically, I minus E times the algebra, times I minus F, is just the zero operator. If you see what this says, it says some nice things geometrically, but I really don't want to take the time to explain all of that. In particular, if V is a unitary operator or a non-unitary isometry on some underlying Hilbert space. So V star V is the identity. So if E, for example, is the identity, then one of the multipliers up there, I minus E times I minus F, is zero. If V is a unitary operator, of course, that's an isometry. Those are extreme points. And as it turns out, the only partial isometries like this in a factor are the isometries, or the adjoints of the isometries, in particular the unitary operators. And it's that fact that gives you the beautiful comparison theory of projections in factors. Well, we could go off into a course here, but let's not. Now, if there's any virtue to that result up there, well, it's not so obvious, but it's daring to look at extreme points in a situation where you're not compact. The norm closed unit ball in the C-star algebra. You see, that was counter to canon in those days. To look at an extreme point for something that didn't come out of Krein-Milman, you see. So what happened was, knowing that result up there, Henry said, gee, I wonder if those extreme points, if their convex closure could be the entire unit ball. Let's even forget about the other isometries. And he and Bernie Russo went to work on that. I don't know, and I don't care how it split up as far as the work is concerned, but they produced this wonderful result. It was just intellectual curiosity, but how useful that result is. So, for example, if you try to show that a positive linear mapping, yes, Bill's nodding, he knows this. If you try to show that a positive linear mapping between two C-star algebras, let's make it nice and easy, that takes the identity to the identity, has norm one, well, we all know that. Go prove it. You can prove it's bounded, you can prove the norm is something less than or equal to the square root of 2, I guess, but try and prove that it's 1. You're going to knock yourself out. Not if you have Russo die. Then it's not an absolute walk away, but it's easy enough to do. Very, very useful result. Now, we come to our first hero here, and in this rebirth. So this was around for quite a while. Their proof is actually a good proof. It's the proof that the Russo-Dye proof, it's the proof that a really good, solid, technical person in the subject would give trying to do this thing. I mean, I could point around the room to a bunch of people who would prove this result. And they'd prove it Bernie Russo, the way Russo and Dye did it. But it's a little bit longish, and you have to have technique to do it that way. Now, what happened was, and this is an illustration too, so as I say, story with local color. How curious and random our lives are, all of us. I mean, the things we wind up doing and what we find ourselves in, we think we have a lot of control over those things. We don't. It's little whims and strange little occurrences come along. You'll see it in just a moment. I was up here giving a lecture in Toronto, May of 83. And after the lecture, a bunch of us went out to dinner, nice dinner. And among those people was Terry Gardner, my dear old pal, and one of my first PhD students when I was at Columbia years ago. So needless to say, we're close pals. We've been that for a long time. And I can't scan the room that quickly. Terry was at dinner. And during the dinner, we had a couple of tables. My table wasn't the same table as Terry's, but we were right next to one another. We had two round tables with about five, six people at each of them. Terry leaned over and tapped me, said, "Dick," he said, "may I ask you a question?" Sure. He said, "would you give me your opinion of this?" And he had submitted a paper, PAMS, Proceedings of the American Math Society. He had submitted a paper, and he'd gotten back a referee's comment. Disquieting to him, slightly disquieting, very slightly. Terry was tolerant, understanding. Terry is tolerant, understanding, wonderful guy. And he wanted to know what my opinion was of the referee's comment on the paper. Whom that referee is, no idea. But all I can do is say bless him, because had it not been for that disquieting comment, Terry would never have asked me the question. He would never have brought the little page. He had found a 2 or 3 page proof of the full proof of Russo Dai. Very lovely proof. And the referee had missed a certain point. Now, we've all had that experience, it is. You're reading somebody's paper, something, and you can't move from one step to the next without a little bit of effort. That's because you're looking at the paper this way, and the fellow who was writing it had been looking this way at the paper. And you sit there for half an hour or an hour. I'm describing, you're not a mathematician if you haven't had this happen to you, I'd say. And so you've all been there, and you're looking, and you're looking, and you're looking, and finally you turn your head this way. Oh! And you say, why? You should have seen that in 1 minute or a half a minute. And it was that kind of a thing that the referee had apparently missed, and he had a good point. His point was, his point was that, look, if you're giving a new proof of something, and we've all seen people try to do this too. Oh, I have a very short proof of this little fact in set theory, the union or whatever. But first you use your Tia-Singer index theorem, or you wave your hand at something that when you really spell it out. Now, the referee was saying, and I think with some justice, that if you're claiming to give a short proof, it should all be there. It shouldn't be something where you just wave your hand. And so Terry Terry had written and had seen, he had his head held this way, and the referee had not seen this particular little point, and I took the paper and I looked and I read his comment, and I guess reading the comment can throw you off, can make you say, well, maybe this is hard and something like that, but somehow it set me so that I was willing to hold my head at a few different angles, and I saw exactly what Terry, and I said, no, he just missed the, we could all do this, he just missed the point of this particular thing. But in the process at dinner, I absorbed the proof. It was neat, and it took, I'll show you. The key observation in the proof was what I've written up here. It's a representation. If you have an operator in the open unit ball, important, and you add to it a unitary, then that is in the C-star algebra, then that is representable as the sum of two unitaries itself. In other words, you can convert that see, you give up a little in the open unit ball, less than one, to another unitary, to a unitary. And express this as the sum of two unitaries. The proof, it's easy. Well, I won't, you know, it's going to take time if I... Here we go. You just look at P plus U, you factor out the U, you notice that you're looking at something, a unitary times an operator less than one in norm, is itself less than one in norm, same norm as T, and so you're a distance less than one away from the identity. This is invertible, and then elementary hocus pocus, and it's the... T plus U is the sum of these two unitaries. Right? Okay. That was Terry's observation. Now, what Terry did was then go off in a certain direction from that observation and give a proof of the standard Rousseau die. Okay. A month or so later, I was off to maybe May. It may have been a little later in May. Maybe a week. I don't really remember how much time elapsed, but not much. I was off to Denmark, to Copenhagen, to spend the year there. Family. Okay, it's 83. So about the first day I was there, Gerd said, "Dick, we have a seminar running, operator algebras. Would you speak at that seminar?" And I'm thinking about it, George. You must have been there. 83. Do you remember that at all? You'd have to think. Yeah, give you time. Okay, I'll give you time. All right. Okay. You usually sit there like this. My lecture and ask me a tough question. A couple of tough questions at some point. I thought I'd ask you a tough question first. Get my tough question in first. Do you remember that? Okay. So I said yes, and I said, you know what I'll do? I'll give it Terry Gardner's new proof of the Rousseau die. There. So I did. Next day, I got up, and I just started to give them Terry's proof. And as I was going along giving the proof, I realized that if I, instead of taking the left fork in the road from this result, if I take the right fork in the road, I would prove that each operator in the open unit ball is a convex combination, finite convex combination. Each operator in the open unit ball is a finite convex combination of unitary operators in the algebra. And easy proof, relatively easy. Well, you'll see, you maybe see it in just a moment. Okay. So, Gerd Petersen, sitting there in the audience, and all of us who know Gerd will recognize this immediately. He went away, and I mentioned that. I say, "Oh, look, you know, you go this way during the lecture, then this and this and this happens." Gerd came back, and he said, "You can even do something with the number of unitary operators, depending on how deep it is inside the unit ball." And then I went away, and the next day I came back, and, "Oh, you can do this and this and this." And I don't remember how many times we went back and forth, but in the period, not, you know, not a gigantic number, maybe three times or something like that, but within a period of maybe 7-10 days, under 2 weeks. This had evolved to the point where Gett and I had proved the following result. And it's something that appears in the 1985 Mathematica Scandinavia. Gett loved that journal, hence it's so appropriate that it's the memorial, the issues of this thing. We proved that if you're 2 over n below the surface of the unit ball, where n is an integer, and I had a little typo there, I crossed it out with this pen, where n is 3 or 4 or 5, what have you, then S is a mean of n unitary operators, U1 to UN. The same n. That's not a mistake. Okay. And the proof, maybe I won't take you through. It's, you know, it's, as we say, it took us about 10 days to produce these few lines. That's our subject. Sit down and try and prove this ab initio. You will write a page or so. You know. But it takes you a little while to see just exactly how to set it up. It's that one long line there. And that what you should be trying to do is look at this. A unitary plus something in the open unit ball. Any t in the open unit ball. Look at this combination. That takes a little while to decide to look at that, as you can imagine. Why? Why that? V plus n minus 1t. Peel off 1t, you have V plus T, N minus 2T. And Terry's result, Terry Gardner's result, says V plus T is U1, and I won't call it U2, U1 plus the new V, V1, plus the N minus 2T. Now peel off another T, and you now have U1 plus V1 plus T, plus n minus 3t, and now look at Terry's result applied to v1 plus t, and that's u2 plus v2, two unitaries because of Terry's result, but you're down one with this, and you keep tracking it through and finally convert the last vn minus 1, you get un minus 1 at the end, plus vn minus 1, convert the last vn minus 1 to un. And then you have this result, V plus N minus 1T. And now apply that to our operator, N minus 1 times NS minus the identity. How do you decide to do that? Well, that takes a couple of days or so, fooling around. You look at this, and you notice that it is less than 1, because S, the operator we're starting with up here, is supposed to be less than 1 minus 2 over n. Okay. And that all works. So this is now an operator less than 1. So this will serve as our t up here. You put that in here. Multiply it by n minus 1. This disappears. Clear everything up. And you finally have that n times s is equal to u1 plus un. So s is a mean of n unitaries. Gosh, it's quick and easy if you know just how to dance your way through it. But as I say, that's our subject. You're going to have terrifically hard results, how many of us, you know. And 10 years later, somebody figures out how to dance, right? That's the thing. Okay, so Gett and I had this. Now, we went on, we spent the rest of the year, we proved lots and lots of results, all kinds of things, very fancy stuff. Both of us felt. We were very happy with that paper. And we asked lots of questions. Along came Mikhail Rordam. He answered them all. Almost all of those. Maybe there was one or two that was sort of still hanging. However, so let's put these guys away. There were other results, many other things, so the subject burgeoned. It had to do with all kinds of things. Mikhail's results led into rank questions. Mikhail Rodan's results led into rank questions. Some of his answers were in terms of, and we had some of that in our paper, distances from the invertibles, and what's the situation when the invertibles are dense. And so forth. I could tell you many more things. There's no time to do that. Just even beginning elementary things. In one sense, the N is sharp here. You can't say 1 minus 2 over N, and it could be N over 2, or the integer part of N over 2. You can't. The N is good there. But there's another question you can ask. And that came up in a paper that Kathy Olson and Gert Peterson wrote. Now, that's more of a Toronto connection, isn't it? Kathy's just over the border there, in Buffalo. She was up here for a while, too. Okay. So. Yeah, let's put this. And this is something that appeared in JFA, Journal of Functional Analysis, a year later. They asked the question, Kathy and Garrett asked the question, suppose S is actually equal to 1 minus 2 over N. Do you still have? Well, that's the kind of thing that analysts fool with. You got less than 1 minus 2 over N. Let it go. But what if the operator actually has norm 1 minus 2 over N? Is it still the mean of N unitaries? And they proved that so in a von Neumann algebra. They also proved that if N is 3 or 4, then it's true in an arbitrary C-star algebra. And then they proved it's true for a normal operator. Only before they sent the paper in, they caught a fatal mistake in their proof. So they went and they talked to Ufa, and he said, fatal mistake, schmatal mistake. Bang! And he proved it. So this was known in the normal case. I had some ridiculously difficult proof in the case one point was missing from the full possible spectrum. You know, the operator has norm 1 minus 2 over N. Its spectrum has to lie in the disk of radius 1 minus 2 over N. And what I proved is if one point is missing from that disk, its spectrum is contained in that disk complement of a point, then the inequality. It was a ridiculous proof. It's just notes somewhere. I don't even know if I can find them anymore. Anyway, Mikhail's work gave a quite a bit simpler proof of that thing. And anyway, it wasn't a full result. But later in 1987, Ufa proved it. Ufa proved the whole shebang. to do it. I see. Now, so move approved that if the norm is, well, so the full result is if the norm is less than or equal to 1 minus 2 over n, where n is 3, 4, 5, so on and so forth, A is in the C star algebra A, then A is a mean of n unitary operators in the C star algebra. And Ulf approved it with exactly the structure that I'm going to give you right now. He established some other of these, what should we call them, representation theorems, representations for operators in terms of unitaries. If T is in the closed unit ball, see, now you're getting away from that open unit ball restriction. T is in the closed unit ball, and you take twice a positive operator in the unit ball, add it to it, that can be represented as a unitary, another unitary, plus the adjoint of that other unitary, where the spectrum of U star V lies on this arc of the circle. So, here's the arc. This is the forbidden part for the spectrum. There's a decomposition with this. Now, what is this crazy spectral condition? Well, you want to take the square root of this operator in the improving this representation. Improving what you're going to use it for. So that's the point to having this arc. And you want to use a continuous function calculus and the C star algebra, and you can do it. You can do it with this part missing. If you take one half, you now have the spectrum lying in the right half plane, and the unitary will have positive real part, and that's very good for what you're going to use it for in here. Okay. The next representation theory, next representation result for which you use lemma 1 is this. If T is in the closed unit ball, and you add twice an operator in P, and I remind you that P of the operator is representable as U times a positive operator in the unit ball of the algebra. Okay. So if T is, if S is such an operator, and you look at T plus 2S, that is now representable as U plus 2R. In other words, you can just trade off the T for a unitary over here. R is again in script T. And then using lemma 2, you can now prove the theorem. Let's see. Now, there's the proof of the theorem. I won't take you through it. This part is not really needed. These few lines are not needed now because we've already done that. I showed that an operator in P is representable as the mean of two unitaries. I showed you that earlier. So one could skip from that affair. It's very easy, and it's an argument of the same type that Gett and I used, going off from Terry Gardner's observation. You just keep peeling off things and using the representations you have for this lemma, and you come out with the result, but you're now not restricted because you've gotten away from the open unit ball. You've been working with T's in the closed unit ball, if you can get those representations. So this is easy enough once you have the representations and if you know where you want to head. Okay. Lemma 2, that's a harder proof, and I'm not going to try and do that. The whole point to this was if everything were running smoothly and on time, I would not have backed into the story so much, and I'd dive right in and drag you kicking and screaming through the proof. The proof's pretty easy, and it's nice, and it's a very satisfying thing once you've taken the time to go through it. And that's the new wrinkle. That's the point. So let me wind up by telling you something about that. Ufer proved this, but it was a monstrosity. The proof of lemma 1 was something like 16 pages or so, and proof of lemma 2 was quite a tough affair. He took the manuscript, this is 87, and he sent it to Gert Peterson. So now we resume the story. By the way, Ufer did this when he was babysitting one evening back in 19. He'd been trying this too, but that particular evening it connected. And he took the manuscript, the long, hard manuscript that he had, and he sent it to Gert Peterson. And Gert, being the irreplaceable, irrepressible Gert Peterson we all knew and loved, many of us knew and loved, he looked at it, and he simplified it tremendously. What does that mean? He cut it in half. Then he sent it to me, and he said, Dick, Ufer, that's the first I heard of it. It all happened within a week or something like this. Ufer sent me a very long something or other. I think I eventually got Ufer's thing in the mail, but it's, you know, the other side of the ocean took some time. He said, I've managed to simplify it, he put that in quotes or something. He said, but I still don't understand it. I mean, the simplification is too hard. Then I took a look at it, and I was able to cut it, I don't know, a quarter. And that's what's here on these slides. And it's now understandable. It's motivated. I can convince you that we are doing what we ought to do at every step of the way. Let's say this experimentally, and an experiment I have repeated. I have done this proof for people, human people, not Ufer. and proved it. And they've understood it and enjoyed it and so on and so forth. So, now, what happened then was Ufer said, he wrote me, he said, Dick, so he got a copy of this. He said, Dick, would you mind hanging on to that until I publish my something or other? And always willing to put anything off that can be put off, I said, sure, and I held it. It is now 20 years later. Ufer has published his thing in some journal, and I had to ask, I had Mikhail Rudam on the phone one time, and I said, Mikhail, do you happen to know where Ufer, I think Ufer published that finally. Do you know where it is? And it was in the 88 proceedings of a U.S.-Japan seminar that Araki and I ran in Pennsylvania, and we are the editors of the proceedings of that. It was in, that's where the paper. Mikko found that out very quickly. You know, he just said the right thing, and there it was. Sure enough, I think in '88 or '89, the paper. Well, 20 years later, I figured Oof has got his paper published. Maybe it's time to spruce this up and publish the thing. And it seemed only reasonable to include Ufa and Gerd Petersen as joint authors. So it's a paper dedicated by the first and second named authors to the third named author, memorial to him. There are still other things to be done, by the way. The subject is not over, not by a long shot. But that's, if I'm back here in another 20 years or so, we'll all be surprised. Maybe I'll do some of those at that time. Thanks very much. Yes, Bob?
Oh, yes.
You see, that N, I was saying, that's what I meant in the beginning. It wasn't very clear. That N is relatively sharp. Take a non-unitary isometry, so the shift, one-way shift, for example, and multiply it by a positive scalar, A, lying between 1 minus 2 over n and something smaller, 1 minus, but you have to think about it, 1 minus 2 over n minus 1. So 1 minus 2, see, n minus 1 smaller than n, and so 2 over n minus 1 is larger than 2 over n, and you subtract it from 1, you get a smaller number, 1 minus 2 over n minus 1. A lies between, it's greater than that and less than 1 minus 2 over n. A times that unitary isometry, so the C-star algebra is B of H, cannot be expressed in fewer than, it can be expressed in n, I sure hope, because that's our theorem, but it cannot be expressed as a convex combination of n minus 1 unitary. Oh, there are all kinds of wonderful things. What about non-means, doing things as means? Suppose you express something as a convex combination. Can you then express it as a mean? Yes, but certainly not obviously so. That requires this key lemma and majorization that does the variant that does all the Pythagoras stuff at the beginning, does the finite, that makes Horn a real honest paper proof. That's part of that. There are all kinds of things in this business. Where do I hide over here, George? Yeah, what? Go ahead. Oh.
I heard that I was aware that something was going on, but I just can't believe that.
You may have been aware. You know, I would almost. You would have asked me something very hard. You probably would have been part of that whole operation that year. And I can't see it not. And I think you may have been away for part of that. There were things going on that summer. The end of that summer, there was the conference. First one in Romania, and of that series, in Neptune. and you weren't, I don't know if you were at that one, but you were, I don't think you were at the seminar. I probably would have remembered if you were there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I might have been here.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Or Queens. I can't remember. Okay. So that mystery is cleared up. Thank you. It would have been. Oh, or 83, it was something else. You're right. 83 was Bushfeni. Yes, you're right. 80 was Neptune. Yeah. Yeah. So I see, that's something, but I've been doing that all my life. You know, I will sometimes interchange something inessential.